I'm Daniel Centeno. You're listening to CGRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative. This is part two of Hostile Designs and Urban Planning in Toronto. Hostile and defensive designs are used to dissuade particular groups from remaining in public spaces. These groups tend to be the homeless and youth populations. While these designs have been overlooked by the general public in the past, there has been more awareness and pushback to make these spaces more inclusive and open for everyone. One of the leading voices in spreading awareness is Defensive TO. Today, its founder, Kyra Shalou, discusses Toronto's use of hostile and defensive designs across the city, what groups are being excluded by them, and how these designs negatively affect everyone using these spaces.
My name is Kyra Shalou. So I am a public space researcher and writer. I have a degree in, I have a master's in environmental studies from York University in planning. And it was there where I studied the politics, design, and regulation of public space, which led to my interest in my work on defensive or hostile architecture.
She describes the early beginnings of Defensive TO when she was a university student and first started to document examples of hostile designs for social media.
So when I was a master's student and I began to look into this topic, one of the first things I did was I began to take pictures wherever I would spot an example of defensive or hostile urbanism. So a bench with a center bar that's meant to keep people who are houseless from lying down on them, or ledges that have these metal protrusions that are meant to keep people from skateboarding. I would take pictures of these elements and I began to post these images and try to figure out what's going on in public space with the hashtag DefensiveTO. So I began on Twitter and then continued this work onto Instagram. I expanded this work as I began to write about it. And I developed an article which was published in the Canadian Journal of Urban Research that looked at the phenomenon, not just in the city centers, but also in our inner suburbs in Toronto. So the piece is called Defending Suburbia.
Hostile designs are placed in several areas around Toronto as ways to uphold an image of perceived cleanliness and safety, according to Shalou.
Yes. So once you start looking for them, it's hard to stop seeing it everywhere. I find that the places where there's the most amount of defensive urbanism, defensive architecture, is in places of high circulation, high traffic. So places like transit stations, public spaces and public plazas that are in downtown cores, places that are meant to be, to look nice, to maybe be a tourism destination like Yonge and Dundas Square. So that there's this attempt to maintain the image of the space as safe and clean and, with no signs of so-called disorder.
The designs are meant to be subtle or unnoticeable. However, there's increasing awareness across major cities today.
Well, I think that people are actually starting to clue in. There's a lot of social media accounts, especially on Instagram, from people all around the world, especially North America and Europe, though, that are starting to document these attempts to use design to guide behavior in certain ways. But I think a main reason why maybe the average person doesn't notice some of these design elements is that it's meant to not draw attention. They're meant to be, they're the coercive mechanism, like let's say the center bar on a bench, doesn't interrupt the use of a bench to sit on. So most people are using a bench to sit on, but once you need it to lie down on, let's say you need to have a nap, you're not feeling well for some reason, you need to lie down, that's when you start noticing these design elements. And sometimes they're more explicit. For instance, a few years ago, outside of Toronto General Hospital, there was this vent grate that people who are homeless were using to rest and to stay warm. Since this grate was in a high traffic area, and the hospital didn't want people sleeping on it, they put this metal installation on it, basically with like undulating kind of metal pieces, so that it was difficult for people to lie down on. But this was very explicit and drew a lot of attention and outrage.
Shilu says hostile designs have been around for quite some time, and it increased in Toronto during the 1990s to deter skateboarders in the downtown core.
Defensive urbanism, or using the built environment to defend space against unwanted use, has been around for a long, long time, as long as we've had cities. You can see older examples in Toronto in the form of fences that protect property. But these newer versions, I believe you really began to see them in the mid 90s when skateboarders were skating in the business district downtown Toronto. There's lots of open plazas, especially during the day and on weekends, that weren't used. And so we started seeing these private property owners put metal caps or pig's ears, anti-skate deterrents, onto ledges so that it would not only protect property, but hopefully deter the skateboarders. But I really believe that it began there. And then as the practice of crime prevention through environmental design, it's a design philosophy that looks at how design can be used to prevent crime, or the fear of crime, the perception of crime. I believe that that became more popular into the mid-2000s. So over the last at least 10, 15 years, we've seen an increase in first in targeted areas, but now widespread use throughout the city, across Toronto, across the country, and around the world.
Like the rest of the world, Toronto's hostile designs target specific areas and groups in public spaces. These targeted groups are viewed as the contrary to the original vision of the public space use.
So it's used to maintain a certain type of public space, a public space that's envisioned by the designers, the property owners, and whoever manages it. So anyone who uses space in a way that is contrary to the intended use, so people who are homeless using a space to hang out in for long periods of time, to maybe sleep, to survive. They are targeted. Skateboarders who like to use these spaces to skate on are also targeted, because they're, you know, it's thought that the skateboards damage property. Also, youth is a big targeted group. Less so in Toronto, but I know that a couple years ago, there was a sound device called a mosquito that was erected in a park, McGill Parkette, close to a youth shelter around Yonge and Girard area in Toronto. And this mosquito device emits a really high-pitched sound that only young ears can hear. As you get older, you can't hear the sound as much. And so this device was erected in this park. I believe that it was meant to deter the youth who were staying at the nearby shelter from using the space.
Commenting on the recent events of homeless encampments uprooted in Trinity Bellwoods this past month, Shilu says tactics to displace people from these public spaces is not new in Toronto.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't have absolute on the ground knowledge of Trinity Bellwoods, but I do know that there were people that were using the public space, the public park, a part of it, as a place to set up tents and tiny shelters. Throughout the pandemic, the city has allowed the erection of structures in these spaces as a way to allow people to protect themselves from COVID, especially since the shelter system really wasn't prepared to deal with an outbreak like what we're facing. And so now that it's the summertime and people are using these public parks more, the city's trying to figure out how to remove people from these public places and these encampments. And so in Trinity Bellwoods, they sent dozens and dozens of tactical police officers, about 100 security guards, to go and clear the encampment, because there's a large community, inside the local community and across Toronto that support our neighbors that are living in tents. And so they sent the police, much like a presence that was witnessed during the G20 in Toronto a decade ago, a really heavy police presence to the park in anticipation of supporters, which they call protesters, but really community supporters who wanted to protect the people living in the park and the spaces that they have to live in. And so a tactic that they used, much like at the G20, was this example of kettling. They won't call it that, but they basically erected a fence around the people who were in the encampment and the community supporters who went to provide support. And they would allow people out, but they wouldn't allow people in. And this fence that has been erected is still there weeks later. And it's still there because the city doesn't want people moving back to the space. They say that it's to protect the grass being sodded, resodded, but we see in other places where there have been encampments. I'm thinking George Hislop Park, around Yonge Street, next to a place called Sanctuary, which does a lot of really great stuff with the unhoused population. Their park has been fenced off, I think, for over a year now, because there were people that were sleeping there as well. So fences are really used to keep people out, and also to displace Kambinuni members who were using the park as a place to survive during this unprecedented crisis.
For future action, Shilu advocates for putting increased pressure on municipalities and policymakers to make concrete outlines of how to make Toronto's public spaces for everyone.
Well, there is increasing awareness amongst the design, planning, and architectural community. But I think that really the pressure needs to be put on to our municipalities and our local governments to develop design guidelines that really make explicit what kind of public spaces we should be designing. I believe that we should be prohibiting the use of exclusionary design features, because really a lot of the clients, the clients of who are creating public spaces are municipalities. So they have the power to decide whether or not they want to have these elements included or not. So I think that as long as we're talking about it, the more that we can get it into the media, to have widespread knowledge about this stuff happening, I find that it usually helps a lot. So I believe that the more that we put pressure on our local officials to do something about this, that we can actually advocate and develop more inclusive public spaces. Defensive or hostile architecture doesn't just affect people who are targeted, but they have unintended consequences for a wide variety of user groups, including people who are disabled. So I'm thinking, for example, one of the main strategies that we see here in Toronto is the lack of amenities. So the lack of benches, the lack of public washrooms, water fountains, things that make being in public space comfortable. And this lack really affects how people can go out and navigate public space. I would say that defensive urbanism creates hostile environments for everyone.
That was part two of Hostile Designs and Urban Planning in Toronto. I'm Daniel Centeno. You're listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative.